I padded back to the office, opened the door, and behind me the telephone rang again. And here was another familiar sensation, back for a return visit after 4 years. That anger at the telephone, the urge to simply rip it out of the wall and fire it across the room. Why did the whole world have to call while I was writing? Why couldn't they just, well, let me do what I wanted? I gave a doubtful laugh and returned to the phone, seeing the wet handprint on it from my last call. Hello? I said to stay visible while you were with her. Good morning to you too, Lawyer Storrow. You must be in another time zone up there, chum. I've got 1:15 down here in New York. I had dinner with her, I said. Outside. It's true that I read the little kid a story and helped put her to bed, but I imagine half the town thinks you're bopping each other's brains out by now, and the other half will think it if I have to show up for her in court. But he didn't sound really angry. I thought he sounded as though he were having a happy face day. Can they make you tell who's paying for your services? I asked. At the custody hearing, I mean? Nope. At my deposition on Friday? Christ, no. Durgan would lose all credibility as guardian ad litem if he went in that direction. Also, they have reasons to steer clear of the sex angle. Their focus is on Maddie as neglectful and perhaps abusive. Proving that Mom isn't a nun quit working around the time Kramer versus Kramer came out in the movie theaters. Nor is that the only problem they have with the issue. He now sounded positively gleeful. Tell me. Max DeVore is 85 and divorced. Twice divorced, in point of fact. Before awarding custody to a single man of his age, secondary custody has to be taken into consideration. It is, in fact, the single most important issue, other than the allegations of abuse and neglect leveled at the mother. What are those allegations? Do you know? No, Maddie doesn't either, because they're fabrications. She's a sweetie, by the way. Yeah, she is. And I think she's going to make a great witness. I can't wait to meet her in person. Meantime, don't sidetrack me. We're talking about secondary custody, right? Right. DeVore has a daughter who has been declared mentally incompetent and lives in an institution somewhere in California. Modesto, I think. Not a good bet for custody. It wouldn't seem so. He also has a son by his second marriage, Roger. His age is... I heard a faint fluttering of notebook pages. 59. So he's not exactly a spring chicken either. Still, there are lots of guys who become daddies at that age nowadays. It's a brave new world, but Roger is a homosexual. I thought of Bill Dean saying, "Rump wrangler. Understand there's a lot of that going around out there in California." I thought you said sex doesn't matter. Maybe I should have said heterosex doesn't matter. In certain states, California is one of them, homosex doesn't matter either, or not as much. But this case isn't going to be adjudicated in California. It's going to be adjudicated in Maine, where folks are less enlightened about how well two married men, married to each other, I mean, can raise a little girl. Roger DeVore is married? Okay, I admit it. I now felt a certain horrified glee myself. I was ashamed of it. Roger DeVore was just a guy living his life, and he might not have had much or anything to do with his elderly dad's current enterprise, but I felt it just the same. He and a software designer named Morris Ridding tied the knot in 1996, John said. I found that on the first computer sweep, and if this does wind up in court, I intend to make as much of it as I possibly can. I don't know how much that will be. At this point, it's impossible to predict. But if I get a chance to paint a picture of that bright-eyed, cheerful little girl growing up with two elderly gays who probably spend most of their lives in computer chat rooms speculating about what Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock might have done after the lights were out in Officer's Country, well, if I get that chance, I'll take it. It seems a little mean, I said. I heard myself speaking in the tone of a man who wants to be dissuaded, perhaps even laughed at. But that didn't happen. Of course it's mean. It feels like swerving up onto the sidewalk to knock over a couple of innocent bystanders. Roger DeVore and Morris Ridding don't deal drugs, traffic in little boys, or rob old ladies. But this is custody, and custody does an even better job than divorce of turning human beings into insects. This one isn't as bad as it could be, but it's bad enough because it's so naked. Max DeVore came up there to his old hometown for one reason and one reason only, to buy a kid. That makes me mad. I grinned, imagining a lawyer who looked like Elmer Fudd standing outside a rabbit hole marked DeVore with a shotgun. My message to DeVore is going to be very simple. The price of the kid just went up, probably to a figure higher than even he can afford, if it goes to court. You've said that a couple of times now. Do you think there's a chance DeVore might just drop it and go away? A pretty good one, yeah. I'd say an excellent one if he wasn't old and used to getting his own way. There's also the question of whether or not he's still sharp enough to know where his best interest lies. I'll try for a meeting with him and his lawyer while I'm up there, but so far I haven't managed to get past his secretary. Rogette Whitmore? Nah, I think she's a step further up the ladder. I haven't talked to her yet either, but I will. Try either Richard Osgood or George Footman, I said. Either of them may be able to put you in touch with DeVore or DeVore's chief counsel. I'll want to talk to the Whitmore woman in any case. Men like DeVore tend to grow more and more dependent on their close advisors as they grow older, and she could be a key to getting him to let this go. She could also be a headache for us. She might urge him to fight, possibly because she really thinks he can win, and possibly because she wants to watch the fur fly. Also, she might marry him. Marry him? Why not? He could ever sign a prenup. I could no more introduce that in court than his lawyers could go fishing for who hired Maddie's lawyer, and it would strengthen his chances. John, I've seen the woman. She's got to be 70 herself. But she's a potential female player in a custody case involving a little girl, and she's a layer between old man DeVore and the married gay couple. We just need to keep it in mind. Okay. I looked at the office door again, but not so longingly. There comes a point when you're done for the day, whether you want to be or not, and I thought I had reached that point. Perhaps in the evening. The lawyer I got for you is named Romeo Bissonette. He paused. Can that be a real name? Is he from Lewiston? Yes, how'd you know? Because in Lewiston that can be a real name. Am I supposed to go see him? I didn't want to go see him. It was 50 miles to Lewiston over two-lane roads, which would now be crawling with campers and Winnebagoes. What I wanted was to go swimming and then take a long nap. A long, dreamless nap. You don't need to. Call him and talk to him a little. He's only a safety net, really. He'll object if the questioning leaves the incident on the morning of July 4th. About that incident, you tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Got it? Yes. Talk to him before, then meet him on Friday at... Wait, it's right here. The notebook pages fluttered again. Meet him at the Route 120 diner at 9:15. Coffee. Talk a little, get to know each other, maybe flip for the check. I'll be with Maddie, getting as much as I can. We may want to hire a private dick. I love it when you talk dirty. Uh-huh. I'm going to see that the bills go to your guy, Goldacre. He'll send them to your agent, and your agent can... No, I said. Instruct Goldacre to send them directly here. Harold's a Jewish mother. How much is this going to cost me? $75,000, minimum, he said with no hesitation at all, with no apology in his voice either. Don't tell Maddie. All right. Are you having any fun yet, Mike? You know, I sort of am, I said thoughtfully. For $75,000, you should. We said our goodbyes, and John hung up. As I put my own phone back into its cradle, it occurred to me that I had lived more in the last 5 days than I had in the last 4 years. This time the phone didn't ring, and I made it all the way back into the office, but I knew I was definitely done for the day. I sat down at the IBM, hit the return key a couple of times, and then began to write myself a next note at the bottom of the page I'd been working on when the phone interrupted me. What a sour little doodad the telephone is, and what little good news we get from it. Today had been an exception, though, and I thought I could sign off with a grin. I was working, after all. Working. Part of me still marveled that I was sitting here at all, breathing easily, my heart beating steadily in my chest, and not even a glimmer of an anxiety attack on my personal event horizon. I wrote, "Next, Drake to Rayford. Stops on the way at vegetable stand to talk to the guy who runs it, Old Source, needs a good and colorful name. Straw hat, Disney World t-shirt, they talk about Shackelford." I turned the roller until the IBM spat this page out, stuck it on top of the manuscript, and jotted a final note to myself. Call Ted Rosenkrief about Rayford. Rosenkrief was a retired Navy man who lived in Derry. I had employed him as a research assistant on several books, using him on one project to find out how paper was made, what the migratory habits of certain common birds were for another, a little bit about the architecture of pyramid burial rooms for a third. And it's always a little bit I want, never the whole damn thing. As a writer, my motto has always been, don't confuse me with the facts. The Arthur Haley type of faction is beyond me. I can't read it, let alone write it. I want to know just enough so I can lie colorfully. Rosie knew that, and we had always worked well together. This time I needed to know a little bit about Florida's Rayford Prison and what the death house down there was really like. I also needed a little bit on the psychology of serial killers. I thought Rosie would probably be glad to hear from me, almost as glad as I was to finally have something to call him about. I picked up the 8 double-spaced pages I had written and fanned through them, still amazed at their existence. Had an old IBM typewriter and a courier type ball been the secret all along? That was certainly how it seemed. What had come out was also amazing. I'd had ideas during my 4-year sabbatical. There had been no writer's block in that regard. One had been really great, the sort of thing which certainly would have become a novel if I'd still been able to write novels. Half a dozen to a dozen were of the sort I'd classify pretty good, meaning they'd do in a pinch, or if they happened to unexpectedly grow tall and mysterious overnight, like Jack's beanstalk. Sometimes they do. Most were glimmers, little what-ifs that came and went like shooting stars while I was driving or walking or just lying in bed at night and waiting to go to sleep. The red shirt man was a what-if. One day I saw a man in a bright red shirt washing the show window of the J.C. Penney store in Derry. This was not long before Penney's moved out to the mall. A young man and woman walked under his ladder. Very bad luck, according to the old superstition. These two didn't know where they were walking, though. They were holding hands, drinking deep of each other's eyes, as completely in love as any 2 20-year-olds in the history of the world. The man was tall, and as I watched, the top of his head came within an ace of clipping the window washer's feet. If that had happened, the whole works might have gone over. The entire incident was history in 5 seconds. Writing The Red Shirt Man took 5 months. Except in truth, the entire book was done in a what-if second. I imagined a collision instead of a near miss. Everything else followed from there. The writing was just secretarial. The idea I was currently working on wasn't one of Mike's really great ideas, Joe's voice carefully made the capitals, but it wasn't a what-if either. Nor was it much like my old gothic suspense yarns. V.C. Andrews with a prick was nowhere in sight this time. But it felt solid, like the real thing, and this morning it had come out as naturally as a breath. Andy Drake was a private investigator in Key Largo. He was 40 years old, divorced, the father of a 3-year-old girl. At the opening, he was in the Key West home of a woman named Regina Whiting. Mrs. Whiting also had a little girl, hers 5 years old. Mrs. Whiting was married to an extremely rich developer who did not know what Andy Drake knew, that until 1992, Regina Taylor Whiting had been Tiffany Taylor, a high-priced Miami call girl. That much I had written before the phone started ringing. Here is what I knew beyond that point, the secretarial work I'd do over the next several weeks, assuming that my marvelously recovered ability to work held up. One day when Karen Whiting was 3, the phone had rung while she and her mother had been sitting in the patio hot tub. Regina thought of asking the yard guy to answer it, then decided to get it herself. Their regular man was out with a flu, and she didn't feel comfortable about asking a stranger for a favor. Cautioning her daughter to sit still, Regina hopped out to answer the phone. When Karen put up a hand to keep from being splashed as her mother exited the tub, she dropped the doll she had been bathing. When she bent to pick it up, her hair became caught in one of the hot tub's powerful intakes. It was reading of a fatal accident like this that had originally kicked the story off in my mind 2 or 3 years before. The yard man, some no-name in a khaki shirt sent over by a day labor outfit, saw what was happening. He raced across the lawn, dove headfirst into the tub, and yanked the child from the bottom, leaving hair and a good chunk of scalp clogging the jet when he did. He'd give her artificial respiration until she began to breathe again. This would be a wonderful, suspenseful scene, and I couldn't wait to write it. He would refuse all of the hysterical, relieved mother's offers of recompense, although he'd finally give her an address so that her husband could talk to him. Only both the address and his name, John Sanborn, would turn out to be a fake. 2 years later, the ex-hooker with the respectable second life sees the man who saved her child on the front page of the Miami paper. His name is given as John Shackelford, and he has been arrested for the rape murder of a 9-year-old girl. And, the article goes on, he is suspected in over 40 other murders, many of them children. "Have you caught baseball, Cap?" one of the reporters would yell at the press conference. "Is John Shackelford baseball, Cap?" "Well," I said, going downstairs, "they sure think he is." I could hear too many boats out on the lake this afternoon to make nude bathing an option. I pulled on my suit, slung a towel over my shoulders, and started down the path, the one which had been lined with glowing paper lanterns in my dream, to wash off the sweat of my nightmares and my unexpected morning's labors. There are 23 railroad tie steps between Sarah and the lake. I had gone down only 4 or 5 before the enormity of what had just happened hit me. My mouth began to tremble. The colors of the trees and the sky mixed together as my eyes teared up. A sound began to come out of me, a kind of muffled groaning. The strength ran out of my legs, and I sat down hard on a railroad tie. For a moment, I thought it was over, mostly just a false alarm, and then I began to cry. I stuffed one end of the towel in my mouth during the worst of it, afraid that if the boaters on the lake heard the sounds coming out of me, they'd think someone up here was being murdered. I cried in grief for the empty years I had spent without Joe, without friends, and without my work. I cried in gratitude because those years seemed to be over. It was too early to tell for sure. One swallow doesn't make a summer, and 8 pages of hard copy doesn't make a career resuscitation. But I thought it really might be so. And I cried out of fear as well, as we do when some awful experience is finally over or when some terrible accident has been narrowly averted. I cried because I suddenly realized that I had been walking a white line ever since Joe died, walking straight down the middle of the road. By some miracle, I had been carried out of harm's way, just as I had carried Kyra. I had no idea who had done the carrying, but that was all right. It was a question that could wait for another day. I cried it all out of me. Then I went on down to the lake and waded in. The cool water felt more than good on my overheated body. It felt like a resurrection. State your name for the record. Michael Noonan. Your address? Derry is my permanent address, 14 Benton Street, but I also maintain a home in TR-90 on Darkscore Lake. The mailing address is Box 832. The actual house is on Lane 42 off Route 68. Elmer Durgan, Kyra DeVore's guardian ad litem, waved a pudgy hand in front of his face, either to shoo away some troublesome insect or to tell me that was enough. I agreed that it was. I felt rather like the little girl in Our Town who gave her addresses, Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, America, the Northern Hemisphere, the world, the solar system, the Milky Way galaxy, the mind of God. Mostly, I was nervous. I'd reached the age of 40, still a virgin in the area of court proceedings, and although we were in the conference room of Durgan, Peters, and Jurette on Bridge Street in Castle Rock, this was still a court proceeding. There was one mentionably odd detail to these festivities. The stenographer wasn't using one of those keyboards on a post that looked like adding machines, but a steno mask, a gadget which fit over the lower half of his face. I had seen them before, but only in old black-and-white crime movies, the ones where Dan Duryea or John Payne is always driving around in a Buick with portholes on the sides, looking grim and smoking Camels. Glancing over into the corner and seeing a guy who looked like the world's oldest fighter pilot was weird enough, but hearing everything you said immediately repeated in a muffled monotone was even weirder. "Thank you, Mr. Noonan. My wife has read all your books and says you are her favorite author. I just wanted to get that on the record." Durgan chuckled fatly. Why not? He was a fat guy. Most fat people I like. They have expansive natures to go with their expansive waistlines. But there is a subgroup which I think of as the evil little fat folks. You don't want to fuck with the elves if you can help it. They will burn your house and rape your dog if you give them half an excuse and a quarter of an opportunity. Few of them stand over 5'2", Durgan's height I estimated, and many are under 5 feet. They smile a lot, but their eyes don't smile. The evil little fat folks hate the whole world. Mostly they hate folks who can look down the length of their bodies and still see their own feet. This included me, although just barely. "Please thank your wife for me, Mr. Durgan. I'm sure she could recommend one for you to start on." Durgan chuckled. On his right, Durgan's assistant, a pretty young woman who looked approximately 17 minutes out of law school, chuckled. On my left, Romeo Bissonette chuckled. In the corner, the world's oldest F-111 pilot only went on muttering into his steno mask. "I'll wait for the big screen version," he said. His eyes gave an ugly little gleam, as if he knew a feature film had never been made from one of my books, only a made-for-TV movie of Being Two that pulled ratings roughly equal to the National Sofa Refinishing Championships. I hoped that we'd completed this chubby little fuck's idea of the pleasantries. "I am Kyra DeVore's guardian ad litem," he said. "Do you know what that means, Mr. Noonan?" "I believe I do." "It means," Durgan rolled on, "that I've been appointed by Judge Rancourt to decide, if I can, where Kyra DeVore's best interests lie, should a custody judgment become necessary. Judge Rancourt would not, in such an event, be required to base his decision on my conclusions, but in many cases that is what happens." He looked at me with his hands folded on a blank legal pad. The pretty assistant, on the other hand, was scribbling madly. Perhaps she didn't trust the fighter pilot. Durgan looked as if he expected a round of applause. "Was that a question, Mr. Durgan?" I asked. And Romeo Bissonette delivered a light, practiced chip to my ankle. I didn't need to look at him to know it wasn't an accident. Durgan pursed lips so smooth and damp that he looked as if he were wearing a clear gloss on them. On his shining pate, roughly 2 dozen strands of hair were combed in smooth little arcs. He gave me a patient, measuring look. Behind it was all the intransigent ugliness of an evil little fat folk. The pleasantries were over, all right. I was sure of it. "No, Mr. Noonan, that was not a question. I simply thought you might like to know why we've had to ask you to come away from your lovely lake on such a pleasant morning. Perhaps I was wrong. Now, if..." There was a peremptory knock on the door, followed by your friend and his, George Footman. Today, Cleveland Casual had been replaced by a khaki deputy sheriff's uniform, complete with Sam Brown belt and sidearm. He helped himself to a good look at the assistant's bust line, displayed in a green silk blouse, then handed her a folder and a cassette tape recorder. He gave me one brief gander before leaving. "I remember you, buddy," that glance said. "The smart-ass writer. the cheap date. Romeo Bissonette tipped his head toward me. He used the side of his hand to bridge the gap between his mouth and my ear. "Divorce tape," he said. I nodded to show I understood, then turned to Durgan again. "Mr. Noonan, you've met Kyra DeVore and her mother, Mary DeVore, haven't you?" "How did you get Maddie out of Mary?" I wondered, and then knew, just as I had known about the white shorts and halter top. Maddie was how Kai had first tried to save Mary. "Mr. Noonan, are we keeping you up?" "There's no need to be sarcastic, is there?" Bissonette asked. His tone was mild, but Elmer Durgan gave him a look which suggested that, should the elves succeed in their goal of world domination, Bissonette would be aboard the first gulag-bound boxcar. "I'm sorry," I said before Durgan could reply. "I just got derailed there for a second or two." "New story idea?" Durgan asked, smiling his glossy smile. He looked like a swamp toad in a sport coat. He turned to the old jet pilot, told him to strike that last, then repeated his question about Kyra and Maddie. "Yes," I said, "I had met them." "Once or more than once?" "More than once." "How many times have you met them?" "Twice." "Have you also spoken to Mary DeVore on the phone?" Already these questions were moving in a direction that made me uncomfortable. "Yes." "How many times?" "Three times." The third had come the day before, when she had asked if I would join her and John Starrow for a picnic lunch on the town common after my deposition. Lunch right there in the middle of town before God and everybody. Although, with a New York lawyer to play chaperone, what harm in that? "Have you spoken to Kyra DeVore on the telephone?" What an odd question. Not one anybody had prepared me for, either. I suppose that was at least partly why he had asked it. "Mr. Noonan?" "Yes, I've spoken to her once." "Can you tell us the nature of that conversation?" "Well..." I looked doubtfully at Bissonette, but there was no help there. He obviously didn't know either. "Maddie, pardon me?" Durgan leaned forward as much as he could. His eyes were intent in their pink pockets of flesh. "Maddie?" "Maddie DeVore. Mary DeVore." "You call her Maddie?" "Yes," I said, and had a wild impulse to add, in bed I call her that. "Oh, Maddie, don't stop," I cry. "It's the name she gave me when she introduced herself. I met her..." "We may get to that, but right now I'm interested in your telephone conversation with Kyra DeVore. When was that?" "It was yesterday. July 9th, 1998. "Yes." "Who placed that call?" Mary DeVore." "Now he'll ask why she called," I thought, "and I'll say she wanted to have yet another sex marathon, foreplay to consist of feeding each other chocolate-dipped strawberries while we look at pictures of naked, malformed dwarves." "How did Kyra DeVore happen to speak to you?" "She asked if she could. I heard her saying to her mother that she had to tell me something." "What was it she had to tell you?" "That she had her first bubble bath." "Did she also say she coughed?" I was quiet, looking at him. In that moment, I understood why people hate lawyers, especially when they've been dusted over by one who's good at his job. "Mr. Noonan, would you like me to repeat the question?" "No," I said, wondering where he'd gotten his information. Had these bastards tapped Maddie's phone? My phone? Both? Perhaps for the first time, I understood on a gut level what it must be like to have $500 million. With that much dough, you could tap a lot of telephones. "She said her mother pushed bubbles in her face and she coughed, but she was..." "Thank you, Mr. Noonan. Now let's turn to..." "Let him finish," Bissonette said. I had an idea he had already taken a bigger part in the proceedings than he had expected to, but he didn't seem to mind. He was a sleepy-looking man with a bloodhound's mournful, trustworthy face. "This isn't a courtroom, and you're not cross-examining him." "I have the little girl's welfare to think of," Durgan said. He sounded both pompous and humble at the same time, a combination that went together like chocolate sauce on creamed corn. "It's a responsibility I take very seriously. If I seem to be badgering you, Mr. Noonan, I apologize." I didn't bother accepting his apology. That would have made us both phonies. All I was going to say is that Kai was laughing when she said it. She said she and her mother had a bubble fight. When her mother came back on, she was laughing, too. Durgan had opened the folder Footman had brought him and was paging rapidly through it while I spoke, as if he wasn't hearing a word. Her mother, Maddie, as you call her. Yes, Maddie, as I call her. How do you know about our private telephone conversation in the first place? That's none of your business, Mr. Noonan. He selected a single sheet of paper, then closed the folder. He held the paper up briefly, like a doctor studying an X-ray, and I could see it was covered with single-space typing. Let's turn to your initial meeting with Mary and Kyra DeVore. That was on the 4th of July, wasn't it? Yes. Durgan was nodding. The morning of the 4th. And you met Kyra DeVore first? Yes. You met her first because her mother wasn't with her at the time, was she? That's a badly phrased question, Mr. Durgan, but I guess the answer is yes. I'm flattered to have my grammar corrected by a man who's been on the bestseller lists, Durgan said, smiling. The smile suggested that he'd like to see me sitting next to Romeo Bissonette in that first gulag-bound boxcar. Tell us about your meeting, first with Kyra DeVore and then with Mary DeVore, or Maddie, if you like that better. I told the story. When I was finished, Durgan centered the tape player in front of him. The nails of his pudgy fingers looked as glossy as his lips. Mr. Noonan, you could have run Kyra over, isn't that true? Absolutely not. I was going 35. That's the speed limit there by the store. I saw her in plenty of time to stop. Suppose you had been coming the other way, though, heading north instead of south. Would you still have seen her in plenty of time? That was a fairer question than some of his others, actually. Someone coming the other way would have had a far shorter time to react. Still, yes, I said. Durgan went up with the eyebrows. You're sure of that? Yes, Mr. Durgan. I might have had to come down a little harder on the brakes, but at 35. Yes, at 35. I told you, that's the speed limit. On that particular stretch of Route 68. Yes, you told me that. You did. Is it your experience that most people obey the speed limit on that part of the road? I haven't spent much time on the TR since 1993, so I can't... Come on, Mr. Noonan, this isn't a scene from one of your books. Just answer my questions, or we'll be here all morning. I'm doing my best, Mr. Durgan. He sighed, put upon. You've owned your place on Darkscore Lake since the 80s, haven't you? And the speed limit around the Lakeview General Store, the post office, and Dick Brooks's all-purpose garage, what's called the North Village, hasn't changed since then, has it? No, I admitted. Returning to my original question, then, in your observation, do most people on that stretch of road obey the 35-mile-an-hour limit? I can't say if it's most, because I've never done a traffic survey, but I guess a lot don't. Would you like to hear Castle County Sheriff's Deputy Footman testify on where the greatest number of speeding tickets are given out in TR-90, Mr. Noonan? No, I said, quite honestly. Did other vehicles pass you while you were speaking first with Kyra DeVore and then with Mary DeVore? Yes. How many? I don't know exactly. A couple. Could it have been three? I guess. Five? No, probably not so many. But you don't know exactly, do you? No, because Kyra DeVore was upset. Actually, she had it together pretty well for it. Did she cry in your presence? Well, yes. Did her mother make her cry? That's unfair. As unfair as allowing a 3-year-old to go strolling down the middle of a busy highway on a holiday morning, in your opinion, or perhaps not quite as unfair as that. Jeepers, lay off, Mr. Bissonette said mildly. There was distress on his bloodhound's face. I withdraw the question, Durgan said. Which one? I asked. He looked at me tiredly, as if to say he had to put up with assholes like me all the time, and he was used to how we behaved. How many cars went by from the time you picked the child up and carried her to safety to the time when you and the DeVores parted company? I hated that carried her to safety bit, but even as I formulated my answer, the old guy was muttering the question into his steno mask. And it was, in fact, what I had done. There was no getting around it. I told you I don't know for sure. Well, give me a guesstimate. Guesstimate. One of my all-time least favorite words. A Paul Harvey word. There might have been three. Including Mary DeVore herself, driving up. He consulted the paper he'd taken from the folder. A 1982 Jeep Scout. I thought of Kai saying, "Maddie, go fast," and understood where Durgan was heading now, and there was nothing I could do about it. Yes, it was her, and it was a Scout. I don't know what year. Was she driving below the posted speed limit, at the posted speed limit, or above the posted speed limit when she passed the place where you were standing with Kyra in your arms? She'd been doing at least 50, but I told Durgan I couldn't say for sure. He urged me to try. "I know you are unfamiliar with the hangman's knot, Mr. Noonan, but I'm sure you can make one if you really work at it." And I declined as politely as I could. He picked up the paper again. "Mr. Noonan, would it surprise you to know that two witnesses, Richard Brooks, Jr., the owner of Dick's All-Purpose Garage, and Royce Merrill, a retired carpenter, claim that Mrs. DeVore was doing well over 35 when she passed your location?" "I don't know," I said. "I was concerned with the little girl." "Would it surprise you to know that Royce Merrill estimated her speed at 60 miles an hour?" "That's ridiculous. When she hit the brakes, she would have skidded sideways and landed upside down in the ditch." "The skid marks measured by Deputy Footman indicate a speed of at least 50 miles an hour," Durgan said. It wasn't a question, but he looked at me almost roguishly, as if inviting me to struggle a little more and sink a little deeper into this nasty pit. I said nothing. Durgan folded his pudgy little hands and leaned over them toward me. The roguish look was gone. "Mr. Noonan, if you hadn't carried Kyra DeVore to the side of the road, if you hadn't rescued her, might her own mother not have run her over?" Here was the really loaded question, and how should I answer it? Bissonette was certainly not flashing any helpful signals. He seemed to be trying to make meaningful eye contact with the pretty assistant. I thought of the book Maddie was reading in tandem with Bartleby, Silent Witness by Richard North Patterson. Unlike the Grisham brand, Patterson's lawyers almost always seemed to know what they were doing. "Objection, Your Honor. Calls for speculation on the part of the witness." I shrugged. "Sorry, Counselor, can't say. Left my crystal ball home." Again I saw the ugly flash in Durgan's eyes. "Mr. Noonan, I can assure you that if you don't answer that question here, you are apt to be called back from Malibu or Fire Island or wherever it is you're going to write your next opus to answer it later on." I shrugged. "If I am, I am. I've already told you I was concerned with the child. I can't tell you how fast the mother was going or how good Royce Merrill's vision is or if Deputy Footman even measured the right set of skid marks. There's a whole bunch of rubber on that part of the road, I can tell you. Suppose she was going 50. Even 55, let's say that. She's 20 years old, Durgan. At the age of 20, a person's driving skills are at their peak. She probably would have swerved around the child and easily. I think that's quite enough. Why? Because you're not getting what you wanted?" Bissonette's shoe clipped my ankle again, but I ignored it. "If you're on Kyra's side, why do you sound as though you're on her grandfather's?" A baleful little smile touched Durgan's lips, the kind that says, "Okay, smart guy, you want to play?" He pulled the tape recorder a little closer to him. "Since you have mentioned Kyra's grandfather, Mr. Maxwell DeVore of Palm Springs, let's talk about him a little, shall we? It's your show. Have you ever spoken with Maxwell DeVore?" "Yes. In person or on the phone?" "Phone." I thought about adding that he had somehow gotten hold of my unlisted number, then remembered that Maddie had done that too, and decided to keep my mouth shut on that subject. "When was this?" "Last Saturday night, the night of the 4th. He called while I was watching the fireworks." "And was the subject of your conversation that morning's little adventure?" As he asked, Durgan reached into his pocket and brought out a cassette tape. There was an ostentatious quality to this gesture. In that moment, he looked like a parlor magician showing you both sides of a silk handkerchief. And he was bluffing. I couldn't be sure of that. and yet I was. DeVore had taped our conversation all right. That underhum really had been too loud, and on some level I'd been aware of that fact even while I was talking to him. And I thought it really was on the cassette Durgan was now slotting into the cassette player. But it was a bluff. "I don't recall," I said. Durgan's hand froze in the act of snapping the cassette's transparent loading panel shut. He looked at me with frank disbelief. And something else. I thought that something else was surprised anger. "You don't recall? Come now, Mr. Noonan. Surely writers train themselves to recall conversations, and this one was only a week ago. Tell me what you talked about." "I really can't say," I told him in a stolid, colorless voice. For a moment, Durgan looked almost panicky. Then his features smoothed. One polished fingernail slipped back and forth over keys marked rewind, fast forward, play, and wreck. "How did Mr. DeVore begin the conversation?" he asked. "He said hello," I said mildly, and there was a short, muffled sound from behind the steno mask. It could have been the old guy clearing his throat. It could have been a suppressed laugh.